Hi, you're listening to NPR on Science. I'm Joe Palca, a correspondent on the science desk here at NPR. How'd you like a free, all-expense-paid trip around the world? Sounds good? Well, just keep listening, because in this edition of On Science, we'll take you to China, Africa, Central America, and the West Indies, where we'll hear about the science and non-science of farming, an unexpected discovery of gorillas, and a newly discovered snake that even the most hardened ophidiophobe would smile at. Actually, I'm not sure that ophidiophobe is a real word. It doesn't appear in the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary, nor the Oxford English Dictionary Online. But if you had to make up a word for someone who fears snakes, ophidiophobe would work very nicely. So why not be scared of this newly discovered snake? Well, my colleague Nell Greenfield Boyce's story will make that clear.
A couple of years ago, biologist Blair Hedges was working on a field guide to amphibians and reptiles of the West Indies. He went to the island of Barbados to photograph animals for his book.
And so we were driving around the island and finding rocks and logs on the side of the road to turn, because these animals tend to get underneath things and hide, you know, during the day.
In a small patch of forest next to a school, he turned over a rock and found a little grayish wiggly creature with yellow stripes.
It does look like a worm. It's actually even, honestly, it's smaller than many worms.
But he knew it couldn't be a worm or a centipede. It had scales and no feet. It was a snake as thin as a spaghetti noodle. At first, Hedges thought it was a species of snake that scientists already knew about from the nearby island of Martinique. But as he looked closer, he realized it was different.
Not only was it a valid species distinct from the one on Martinique, but also was smaller.
In fact, he now says it's the smallest species of snake in the world. In the journal Zootaxa, he says adult snakes of this species average just under 4 inches. Now, Hedges is an evolutionary biologist at Penn State University, and this isn't the first time he's found something super tiny. He's previously identified the world's smallest frog species and the world's smallest lizard. He swears it's just a coincidence that he's now found the smallest snake.
You could never search for a smallest anything, and so this is luck times three, really.
Part of his luck could come from the fact that he's done a lot of work on islands. The tiny snake, frog, and lizard all live on islands. And Hedges says islands are known to host an unusual number of small species. Still, he says, after 3 world records...
I find it highly unlikely that I will ever find the smallest anything for the rest of my life.
Which is too bad, because he's gotten good at perching tiny creatures on top of coins to take photos showing how small they are. The snake, for example, looks very sweet on top of a quarter. He named it...
Leptotiflops Carly.
After his wife, Carla. I wanted to see just how tiny this snake really was. Hedges had already donated his snakes to the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., so I went there. Scientist Roy McDermid showed me 2 glass jars full of alcohol. Each had a snake floating inside.
Sit down here. Here are the specimens.
They're cute.
I think they're pretty neat looking, but cute is not where I would go, but that's fine. If you had one of these things, you'd think, well, that's kind of a weird little thing, but they don't have a striking coloration. They're hard to sort of see what their head looks like and imagine what they do.
Mostly what these snakes do is eat insect larvae. They're harmless to people. McDermid and a colleague seemed amused that someone was after the title of the world's smallest snake instead of the biggest and the baddest. Now that the claim is out there, maybe someone will say they've got a tinier one. But Blair Hedges thinks his little guys are probably close to the limit of how small a snake can be and still be a snake. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Although I may be a bit hasty in suggesting the new snake wouldn't bother true ophidiophobes, maybe this is an occasion where size doesn't matter. Let's leave the sunny West Indies and head off to Africa, where my colleague John Nielsen has a story about an unexpected discovery of gorillas.
2 years ago, researchers from the New York-based Wildlife Conservation Society and Congolese wildlife experts started looking for gorillas in one of the least passable forests left on Earth. forests near the border between the Republic of Congo, Brazzaville, and Cameroon. Researchers had heard from people living nearby that there might be gorillas in these forests. If the researchers had found nothing, team leader Emma Stokes says she wouldn't have been surprised.
We were worried about that. You know, this is a block of forest that not many people are walking around in. So we didn't really know in some bits of this area what we were going to find. I mean, we really didn't.
They followed tracks, counted droppings, and found gorilla nests. And every now and then, after sitting on a platform for an hour or two, Stokes would see a gorilla come out into a swamp, and then another, and then a whole family. And there are infants playing in the swamp, she said. And the perfect moment is sitting there, seeing gorillas do what gorillas do. In the end, says Stokes, they found more gorillas than she thought possible.
I mean, we ran the analysis on this five times over. We weren't trusting the numbers we were getting, but the numbers kept coming in high, whichever way you looked at it. However conservative you were with the estimate, the numbers were still coming up very high.
The discovery was announced at a meeting of the International Primatological Society in Edinburgh, Scotland. Steve Sanderson, CEO and president of the Wildlife Conservation Society, said 125,000 gorillas live in these forests. That's more than the current world estimate for the species, which is somewhere between 50 and 100,000.
We have found a mother load of western lowland gorillas. We had no idea that these great numbers and also densities, that is, numbers per square kilometer, were possible.
Sanderson says the apes in the mother lode are not being killed by the things that have all but wiped out gorilla populations in other parts of Central Africa. Wars, commercial poaching, massive logging operations, and any number of diseases.
Diseases led by but not limited to the Ebola virus have created big empty holes in the forest where gorillas used to be but are no longer.
One of the main reasons these newly found gorillas have been avoiding these fates is obvious to anyone who's ever spent time in the swampy forest known as the Green Abyss. Like Richard Ruggiero of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who studied gorillas and elephants for 15 years in Central Africa. He didn't help with this census, but he knows the area well.
We call it the Green Abyss because we didn't know about it, and you go into it, and it's a world unto itself. It's, you know, these swamp environments are extremely difficult to get along in. There's literally no place to pitch a tent and sleep. You have to now walk on roots and in slippery places.
This is a notoriously difficult place to count anything. But even if the census numbers turn out to be a little high, Ruggiero says it's still an amazing find. He says that right now there aren't any logging operations in these forests, which means that the roads are all but non-existent. That in turn means there hasn't been much poaching or subsistence hunting. Basically, there aren't many humans here at all, he says. But that may be about to change. In recent years, Ruggiero says the government of the Republic of Congo has started to sell the right to log these forests.
Where there are natural resources in Africa, the rush to exploit them is at a pace that no one ever dreamt possible. It's horrific, frankly. The value of this announcement of this large populations is hopefully people will realize this is a chance to get there before the other guys do and to figure out a better way to plan, if you will, to manage the resource, if you will, than leaving it up to people with chainsaws and bulldozers. And that story tells itself, and it's a sad story.
Steve Sanderson of the Wildlife Conservation Society says the government of the Republic of Congo is considering a plan to turn a big part of this forested area into a wildlife park.
This new park of the 125,000 estimated gorillas found, this new park has 73,000. So it's a big deal. And the establishment and maintenance of the park are difficult, but certainly not impossible.
Sanderson also says there are ways to save gorillas that won't be protected by a park. In recent years, his group has helped big logging operations in other parts of the Republic of Congo learn to harvest trees sustainably and to limit poaching operations that rely on logging roads. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
Now, from fauna to flora and Africa to Central America, Honduras to be precise. Dan Charles spent some time there earlier this year. Dan's written extensively about genetically modified foods. He's even got a book on the subject. Here's the plug, Lords of the Harvest, Biotech, Big Money, and the Future of Food. There's been a huge debate about whether genetically engineered crops will help end world hunger or just make big profits for ag biotech companies. As Dan reports, farmers in Honduras seem to think genetically modified seeds are a good idea.
Rodolfo Rubio rips the husk off an ear of corn and shows off the gleaming rows of white kernels. There are no worms in this corn, which is quite remarkable because those worms are everywhere here in central Honduras, and Rubio hasn't sprayed anything on this field to kill them.
No. The only thing we need here is the seed, the fertilizer, and the herbicide.
The secret is in the corn itself. Years ago, scientists at the company Monsanto took a gene from a kind of worm-killing bacteria and inserted it into an ancestor of these corn plants. So if worms start munching on the corn, they die. Rubio doesn't have to spray insecticides the way he used to. He lifts up a corn leaf and points to another kind of insect hiding underneath.
Este es un insecto benéfico.
This is a beneficial insect that eats the worms. They are safer on this land because there aren't any insecticide residues here.
Rubio started growing Monsanto's genetically modified corn 4 years ago. He pays about $1,000 extra for enough corn seed for 30 acres. But he says this technology saves him so much time and money, he can't imagine not using it.
If someone tells me that the government wants to limit my access to technology, that's like telling me that I don't have the right to a better life or more profit. And it wants to see me sink into poverty.
But in the rest of Central America, growing this corn is against the law. Corn is more than a crop here. It's history and culture. Central America is where farmers first grew corn thousands of years ago. And in some places, you can still find an almost infinite variety of corn plants. Jacqueline Chenier, who is director of a Honduran organization that promotes small-scale organic agriculture, says bringing in unnatural genes threatens the integrity of this natural treasure.
When you come with genetically modified variety, genes cross with those other varieties, and what you have is contamination because you have a strange gene in those varieties. So they are not what they were before.
Last year, Chenier thought these arguments might be getting somewhere. The country's new Minister of Agriculture said the country might stop growing or importing genetically modified crops, often called GMOs. Then came the food crisis. Corn doubled in price. And just a few weeks ago, that same Minister of Agriculture said he now wants farmers to plant more corn, including genetically modified corn. Robert Parlberg, a professor at Wellesley College, says concern over food shortages may be shifting government policies in other countries, too.
Egypt has approved GMO corn. China has just announced a large increase in its research budget for GMO foods.
But it's not a big shift. Genetic engineering still isn't welcome across much of Latin America, Asia, and especially Africa.
It's been criminalized by the regulatory systems of developing countries.
Parlberg thinks that's terrible because he says this technology can help farmers, even poor farmers. Monsanto certainly thinks so. It has big plans in Honduras. Rita Perdomo, a marketing manager for the company, says Honduran farmers increased their planting of genetically modified corn this year by 50%. It's still only about 15% of the country's corn crop, though.
Hopefully, by 2012, 40 to 50% of those 500,000 acres will be planted with varieties that include biotech traits.
She thinks, as a result, Honduras's production of corn per acre will double or even triple, and the country will no longer have to depend on imported corn for tortillas and animal feed. Others scoff at this prediction. Most farmers in Honduras are poor, too poor to spend much money on corn seed or anything else that would boost their production, like fertilizer or irrigation. Even the skeptics, though, are watching events in Honduras carefully to see whether first world biotechnology can, in fact, make a difference for third world farmers. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
And finally, we're off to China. Earlier this year, Melissa Block and several other members of the All Things Considered staff went to China to do a bunch of feature stories. They went to Chengdu province. Well, talk about being in the right place at the right time, at least in a news sense, because that's where there was this big earthquake last May. So all the news features that they were planning while they were there had to be put on hold while they covered the giant disaster that was taking place there. Well, now Melissa is producing some of those features. It's not, strictly speaking, what I'd call a science story, But I like it for the different perspective it brings about farms and farming from the piece you just heard from Dan Charles. Here's Melissa Block.
We start today with a visit to an organic farm just south of Chengdu. Its name translates to Fruit Garden Fragrant Pig, but it sounds a lot better in Chinese. That's Chen Xia. She's a graduate student active in the organic farming movement around Chengdu. And in April, she brought me to meet the farm's owner, 37-year-old Lo Yu.
Good morning, ni hao.
Lo Yu is slim with wire-frame glasses, an unlikely farmer. He used to be a stockbroker, earning several thousand dollars a month, but he was stressed out. Then he heard about organic farming from some Taiwanese friends. He read some books and was intrigued. So he spent 6 months driving around China looking at conventional farms, and what he saw terrified him. Agriculture that was depleting the soil, destroying the ecosystem. Food riddled with pesticides, unsafe to eat. So here he is, 7 years later, running his own organic farm. Lots of fruit trees, vegetables, and pigs.
We are now going to see a mother pig who has given birth to 11 little pigs, but we have to be quiet.
Oh, okay. When did she have the babies?
This morning.
This morning she had the babies. Oh, there they are. Big mama, and they're tiny. They must be about a little bit bigger than my hand.
Okay.
As Lo Yu leads me through his farm, he points out the plastic bottles hanging off the plum and peach trees. They have a big hole cut in them, and they're filled with sugar water to attract and trap bugs. Lo Yu tells me he expects to lose one-third of his crops to bugs, another third to birds, leaving him just one-third to sell.
Those bugs have the right to stay here. They're part of the food chain. If we kill them, then there will be no birds on the farm. Eventually, there will be only human beings on the planet. It will be a silent spring.
Silent spring, like Rachel Carson.
Imagine the surprise of Lo Yu's well-educated parents when he told them he was leaving the world of finance and going back to the land. This is, after all, a country where people aspire to move up and out of the countryside. His parents said, "You're crazy. You're going back to ancient times." But he says, "I don't see this as moving backward. I'm moving forward." As we walk, Lo Yu calls out a greeting to some farmers working in rice paddies at a neighboring farm. It's not organic.
In fact, they don't use pesticides or chemicals on the produce they grow to eat themselves. But they do use pesticides on the produce they sell because they're going after yield. They'll do whatever will earn them the most money.
And the economics of organic food in China don't work in Lo Yu's favor. There's the lower yield, for starters. And in the market, organic food costs 2 to 3 times more than conventional food. It can be a tough sell. As we walk, Lo Yu bends down and turns over a cabbage leaf to point out its imperfections.
There are holes underneath this huge cabbage leaf. Do you find that your customers now, when they're buying your organic produce, wouldn't mind finding holes in their cabbage leaves? They don't expect a perfect vegetable right now.
Right. They're reassured to see the holes on these green leaves because they know this means we don't use any chemicals. But this could never be sold on the conventional market.
Lo Yu has about 50 buyers now for his weekly market baskets. He used to make most of his money serving organic lunches to visitors, but that business plummeted after the earthquake. Same with the restaurants who buy from him. He's selling them about 10% of what he used to. Even before the earthquake, Lo Yu hadn't been able to turn a profit in his 7 years of farming. He's managed to stay afloat with the help of some local investors and his own savings. Still, he's committed to bringing more farmers into the organic fold and promoting organic food to people increasingly concerned about healthy living. He's tired, but also determined to make this farm work.
In the past, it was just a dream, a hope. But this year, we're so much closer. We've proved that we've been heading in the right direction this whole time. I believe that once you start something, you should stick with it. If you stumble, stand up again. As long as you keep the faith, nothing can defeat you.
That's Law Yu, who runs the Fruit Garden Fragrant Pig Organic Farm outside Chengdu, China.
Fruit Garden Fragrant Pig. What a great name! Maybe for a chain of drive-in restaurants. Fruit Garden Fragrant Pig, home of the redolent porky. Try it with our secret mango sauce and lychees. And don't forget our world-famous cabbage shake. You want fries with that? Okay, that's all for this edition of NPR on Science. I'm Joe Palca.